Stay tuned. Nature News is coming up next, right here on WTZQ.
Join us now for an informative look at the world of nature with local naturalist and educators Carlton Burke and Dan Lazar, reporting on all the natural events occurring right here in wild western North Carolina. From bugs to bears and everything in between, get ready to explore the rich natural heritage of our southern Appalachian Mountains.
Hello out there, and welcome to another broadcast of Nature News, a program that keeps you aware of what's happening out there in the wilds of western North Carolina and the surrounding southern Appalachian Mountain region, which is our focal area that we talk most about. And my name is Carlton Burke. I'm one of your routine, regular co-hosts here at Nature News.
And my name is Dan Lazar. I'm your other co-host.
Well, it means there are two of us in the studio here, and usually are, except when Dan goes off to play, which he does a few times a year. But Dan, you're not going to leave this time of year to go anywhere else, because where would you want to be anywhere else in the world except right here? Springtime in the Appalachian Mountains.
Nowhere. I'd rather be
nowhere. That's why you're
here. A couple times of the year when I would not want to be anywhere else but here on the whole earth, and that would be spring, like the month of January, which is April 15th to May 15th, and also in October.
Right.
There's nothing more beautiful.
It is a great place, and I especially love spring. I get excited this time of year, and with the weather warming up and some of the cool breezes we've been having these nice summer days, you know, and the first butterflies floating through, the first flowers coming up, the grass is greening, you know, and they drive through the neighborhoods and everybody's got their lawnmower out mowing the grass, you know. But that's the sounds of spring. And of course, the sounds of spring also include a lot of singing birds,
yeah,
and a lot of singing things like toads and spring peepers and animals like that in the amphibian world. And what can I say? Spring is just a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful season. At least around here. I bet there's some place in the world where spring is not so great, but here it's just very, very satisfying.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
Yeah, well, to some things we got today to talk about on Nature News, a little preview. Definitely going to have to talk about some wildflowers, and Dan has been out doing a lot of hiking, and you have a list of how many wildflowers?
68
wildflowers bloom. Well, I don't know that we'll talk about all of those.
Not going to go through
but
all
just
those.
To show you that there is as many as that in bloom in certain locations.
This is on one hike, 68.
On one hike, yeah. One hike. So, yeah, there's a lot of things in bloom. We have some news about a rattlesnake today.
Yeah.
Rattlesnake sighting. We're going to talk about. Also, last week we ran out of time for it, but today we're going to have another installment in our series, What's in My Pocket?
Yeah.
Some kind of nature-related object that is tucked away in either my pocket or Dan's pocket, and we kind of have the other person guess what it is and take it out and talk about it. And you know, if you were ever to check my pockets whenever I walk and come home from the woods, invariably I'll have something in it, because I'm a little bit of a souvenir hunter.
Okay.
And I like to pick up all kinds of little curios and things I find in the woods that are very interesting, and I save them. And
so you're a nature kleptomaniac.
Yeah. You know, the fact is, it's true. Ever since I was a kid, I have liked to collect things from the world of nature. And one of my big things I collected in the world of nature when I was a kid was snakes. You know, and but there were a lot more snakes back in those days. But I had pet turtles, pet snakes, all kinds of things. I still have pet turtles and pet snakes, but I use them in educational programs and things like that these days. But I've always liked to, I'm just one of those people that like to have something in your house that you go, I like that. You know, and I don't have to go look at a picture of it. I don't have to go in my memory. So I go look over the aquarium. There's one sitting right there, and I pick it up and handle it and touch it, you know.
Okay.
That's not for everybody. But, yeah, I have always been a bit of a collector, and I have to kind of make myself not do that sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can have photographs. You can have videos. You can have paintings. But you can't really replace eye-to-eye contact with some object from nature. I mean, that's why people go hiking, go out in the woods, and of course, most people are happy to encounter them out in the woods, but you take it a step further. So that's what makes you unique, Carl.
Well, that's what made me get interested in nature when I was a kid, when I touched a snake for the first time in an educational zoo tour And then I went out and caught my very first snake.
Oh, what was your
before
first
then? Part? First snake I caught?
Yeah, yeah.
Eastern worm snake.
Wow.
And so I was so excited about that. And then learning about these things, I just, you know, young boys just naturally have a tendency to want to bring living things home. And most people grow out of that. And, you know, but I kept growing into it more, you know. And I've just always want to be surrounded by things.
Well, someday when you mature, maybe you'll stop doing that.
Yeah, maybe when I'm mature. I'm old enough to be mature now, but I may not be mature enough mentally.
Okay.
But in case, I'm half co-host of Nature News.
Yeah.
I was mature enough to do a Nature News program and talk to people out there about the world of nature and share our knowledge and with folks out there. And we will tell you how to get in touch with us here at Nature News in a few minutes, because we like to get questions about things from the world of nature, observations that you see,
yep.
topics for discussion, comments about the program, good or bad, or just say, hey, we're listening to Nature News, and we got a good listener base out there, but a lot of times we don't hear from just a few of them because they're busy like us, you know, but sometimes we hear from people we've never heard of, and they've been listening for years, and they'll have a cool sighting or something they want to share with us, or maybe a nice photograph of something they've seen. But in any case, yeah, we love to get in touch with our listeners, so we'll tell you how to do that here in just a little bit.
Okay.
Meanwhile, what do you want to start our Nature News program off with today, Dan?
I don't know. I don't know if this is the right way to start, but have we ever started with Roadkill Report?
I think once or twice we probably have.
Okay.
Tell people what a Roadkill Report is.
Well, it's a way of gathering information by observing roadkill animals, and it is actually a scientific method, and it has been used in published reports in scientific journals. You can assess the population levels of animals. You can assess the ranges, especially range expansions or contractions, by just observing. It's kind of a random sampling of animals in the vicinity. So we call it Roadkill Report.
And we're not making fun of it.
No. Nope.
Like some people do roadkill stuff. And it is a little bit of a downer because I hate to see animals killed on a highway. But the fact is we have a healthy roadkill report anytime we want to give one usually, which means that we have a healthy population of wild creatures in the area, but unfortunately they have to cross highways in their day-to-day travels and many of them get hit.
Right.
But that does show that there's a cross-section sampling of, there are many things out here in our Appalachian forest. And some things we see more routinely at certain times of the year, like for instance, in February.
Uh-huh.
It's the time we see more skunks because it's skunk breeding season. We see more male dead skunks along the highway, you know, and maybe come along, say, mid to late July, early August, start seeing a lot of young groundhogs hit on the highway as they leave their mother's burrows
right.
and start to fend for themselves across highways, you know. And then and usually right around the mid to late November, early December, it's the rutting season where deer are actually breeding and bucks are chasing the does, and a lot of deer have a tendency to cross highways and get hit. So those things indicate breeding populations, migration patterns, all kinds of things. But today on Roadkill Report, personally, I have a hodgepodge of many different things.
Okay.
Do you have anything to put on Roadkill Report?
I don't have anything.
Okay, all right. So it's all my telling here.
Okay.
So this week on Roadkill Report, no one thing that was more common than others. Well, I guess I'd take that back. Squirrels.
Okay.
A lot of squirrel activity right now. And so you got to watch out, but that's true most of the time. But squirrels get really active in the springtime as well, look around for new food sources and that sort of thing. And they've already had a litter back in March. It's maturing. And like just this morning, I was driving out and left my house, and it was no more than about 100 feet away from my mailbox. There was my first roadkill squirrel of the day, which I stopped to look at. And then there was another squirrel on the edge of the pavement nearby. And I picked the one up, and it was a young male. And I looked at him, and he was probably a young male or maybe a young female. So they're probably siblings,
uh-huh.
and they're probably just playing in the woods and maybe went across the road to one of the walnut trees in the vicinity to get a walnut or something, and this one got hit by a car. But a lot of roadkill squirrels this week as well. Also, I saw a wild turkey.
Uh-huh.
I didn't have a chance to stop at it and look at it. I was out on an interstate highway in Henderson County. Otherwise, I would have stopped and taken a look. And this, I think this was down near the Green River area, going down towards Lake Summit area, Tuxedo, if you know that area. And it looked like it was hit by a car right there along the guardrail section in the median of the highway there. And this is the time of year where a lot of turkeys are pretty active. In fact, as I was going to another place in Henderson County the other day, down that same general area. In fact, it was on the same day I saw the roadkill turkey, and I saw drove by, and I was on my way to an appointment. I didn't have time to stop, but I saw a female turkey right on the edge of the road, and I'm pretty sure I saw some turkey poults with her.
Oh, really?
Yeah, what I thought was maybe a little bit early. So I said, was that an early little baby turkeys with her? Or was I just seeing things? But I would have turned around and gone back, but I was in a hurry. So, and this is the breeding season for turkeys. So male turkeys, the toms, are looking for female turkeys, and they round them up and call to them and sing love songs and stuff like that, and assemble a harem. So, you know, they're active this time of year, so yeah, we'll sometimes see them hit on a highway. Not in large numbers, but the occasional wild turkey. I also saw... I didn't have a chance to stop too. I was always in a hurry. I've been in a hurry this week a lot.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And I saw what identified at about 65 miles an hour with two quick glances, one looking out the window, one in my rearview mirror, what could only have been a muskrat.
Oh.
But it was torn up pretty good, and I could recognize the really reddish fur that it had. And it didn't look like it was that close to any water source either, but there might have been a little creek or stream nearby. And we don't see a lot of roadkill muskrats. Or
that's true.
People do. They probably don't realize what it is. And I usually see like one a year, something like that, in certain locations. And about 2 weeks ago, I added on to this week's roadkill report, I did see a roadkill beaver.
Really?
And I'm trying to remember exactly where that was, you know, but I think that was in Buncombe County, not far from the French Broad River, I think, if I'm not mistaken. But
that,
we also
unusual.
Don't see a lot of roadkill beavers, but it does occur from time to time.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And this was pretty, it was a little bit on the smaller size.
Right.
And when I say smaller size, you know, the average, you know what the average size of a beaver is in the mountains here?
What?
About 30 pounds.
Oh, that's pretty big.
Yeah, 25, 30 pounds. So, you know, if you go up north in the northeastern United States and central Canada, places like that, there are beavers that routinely top 50 pounds or more. And I think I've heard reports of like 90-pound beavers
what?
And stuff like that. You know, in some of the northern states,
gosh.
You know, they pretty big in the northernmost areas. But down here, yeah, more like 25, 30 pounds for a big adult.
Yeah.
But they are a very, very heavy aquatic mammal. But they do come out of the out onto the highways as across from one body of water to another. They don't always stay in a creek or something like that. But sometimes they'll take a shortcut across the highway. And let's face it, they're not the fastest creature to cross the highway. They're closer related to groundhogs, and groundhogs waddle across the highway, and so do beavers. In fact, one time over in the Asheville area, just off the Swannanoa River area, a part of the Swannanoa River area that was decimated by the Hurricane Helene, you know, back in 2024 here, September 2024, one evening there was a beaver, and I don't know what his, he was disoriented or something, but he was right in the middle of an intersection at night, walking back and forth. And it's like he couldn't figure where he wanted to go. And I don't think he'd been hit and disabled or anything like that. And I finally had to go over there and kind of goose him on the back and his tail and kind of hurt him off the road to get him going the back direction to where the wetland was that he probably came from. But if you ever see a beaver walking around on land, you might say, what in the heck is that? Because it's just out of context. It's not where you normally would see a beaver, is normally seen swimming in the water. But lots of things are active right now, so be careful out there.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of movement going on.
Yeah.
That beaver story reminds me of one of my favorite all-time nature news stories.
Okay.
You probably know what it is. The flood along the French Broad.
Oh, I think I remember.
In the 90s.
Yeah, this was a long time ago.
And a young beaver got washed up on the bridge in Marshall that goes out to the island. And a fireman came and gave it mouth-to-mouth resuscitation.
Mm-hmm.
That sticks in my mind. That is a really interesting nature news story.
Yes.
Mouth-to-mouth resuscitation.
And it survived.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm very much pro-beaver. I like beavers. They're a keystone species, and I know a lot of people out there dislike them, but I am very much for beavers. They're very, very important. And
that's true. There are some people, especially arborists, people who really like trees, people who do landscaping anywhere near a river, and then the beavers come and chew down their trees. I know a lot of people.
Well, there's easy ways to negate that damage. It's not that hard to control that kind of damage, but they do often flood areas where low-lying highways are, or where we're trying to grow crops and things and reclaim wetland, low-lying areas, which actually should not be, but maybe farmed. But should not be building because that's repairing habitat. But we won't get into politics right now. But in any case, you will not hear me say very many things, if anything bad, about beavers on Nature News. I am a staunch defender of the beaver.
Okay, good. All right, well, that takes care of roadkill report.
Right.
What next?
Oh, well, Dan,
yep.
How about we had a report of a rattlesnake.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe we'll hear about this rattlesnake report. And maybe after that we'll go into our wildfire report.
Okay.
Because that's such a spring topic. But actually seeing a rattlesnake this early in the season is very unusual, and I'll tell you why in just a moment.
Okay. Well, this rattlesnake was sighted in, actually, South Carolina, right on the Blue Ridge Escarpment at a nature area called Chestnut Ridge.
I have been there a few times.
And so it would have been on a south-facing slope, you know, a little bit warmer of a habitat. No other details than that's where it was.
Was it like crossing a trail or something? Like that?
It was in the woods and was seen along a trail.
Right, okay.
Okay.
Well, you know, that's not unusual to see a rattlesnake in the mountains because we have a lot of rattlesnakes in certain parts of the mountains. Other parts of the mountains, rattlesnakes are a species that's in decline, and they are protected in most places north and South Carolina from being collected and harmed and that sort of thing. But the fact is, you know, some other snake species have been active recently. You know, we've had some reports of garter snakes, a black rat snake, and a few other things being seen by some people. But rattlesnakes typically don't get active in the spring until very late spring. And the reason is because most rattlesnakes, but not all of them, many of them actually have these places they go to hibernate that they go each and every year. And a lot of times they're rocky hillside dens or rocky boulders and stuff that have a south-facing exposure to where it's sunny. And they go down to these little cracks and crevices in there, and they'll come out in the sun when it's warm in the afternoon, but then at night it's still getting cold, and they stay around those dens and go back down in the crevices. And, you know, even into May, mid-May, we sometimes have freezing temperatures in the mountains, so you're not out of the woods as far as freezing temperatures go. But obviously, things are starting to warm up a little bit more, and maybe we won't have very cold temperatures later, but we might.
Yeah, this would have been earlier this week when we had sunny, warm, 70-plus degree days.
Yeah. So, depending on where the sighting was, you know, maybe it was just close to where they were denning, and maybe it wasn't on the move, but it seems like most rattlesnakes don't leave their dens and start actually moving to their spring and summer range until the nights start getting pretty warm, because they like to travel mostly at night. Okay. Even though during the springtime, they'll probably travel a lot during the daytime. But, you know, they just kind of instinctively know it. Hey, it's not time to leave my safety of my den, because if they're caught out with no denning site and places to go underground, they could freeze to death. So that's why I'm saying it's a little early to be seeing a rattlesnake. But if you're very close to where a rattlesnake hibernates, then it might be out sunning itself. And also, there are some rattlesnakes that do not go to these hillside rocky dens, because a lot of those places have been destroyed, or the populations that are associated with them have been persecuted by people, because people, you know, to this day, most people do not appreciate things like rattlesnakes and other venomous snakes. But there are some individual rattlesnakes will hibernate in other spots. There are rattlesnakes that have been known to hibernate in like little wet stream cave openings and stuff like that, where they might even be a little bit wet in the winter time, but the water that keeps it above freezing.
Yeah.
So down around a stream or something like that, or going down a big hole in the ground, maybe an old groundhog burrow or some kind of crevice under one or two boulders, not a big cliffside face or something like that, or maybe what do we call a stump hole, which would be just where something was like a tree, if it rotted out, but it left a big stump opening where the stump rotted out, but it's got a big opening full of leaves and maybe even rotten pieces of wood that go down a couple feet underground. And I know I pull copperheads out of places like that with my snake hook pulling up, you know. So some individual rattlesnakes have taken advantage of hibernating in individual spots and not following the norm of going to the main den as they used to in the wild. And it might be some different behaviors just because people have persecuted rattlesnakes so much that some of them have probably actually changed their operational way they survive. In fact, it's been proven that some places where if you see a rattlesnake routine, like as part of this regular place where it likes to live, you know, in a food spot, you know, if it disturb it more than once, twice, a lot of times, you'll never see it there again. It kind of associates that as a dangerous spot and may completely change its day-to-day movements to not include that spot anymore.
Right.
So that's kind of interesting. But I'd like to see a rattlesnake right now.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, this was, you know, of course, South Carolina, a little bit warmer. It was on a south-facing slope. And
South Carolina rattlesnake probably wake up a little bit earlier in hibernation than our North Carolina mountain rattlesnakes do.
Yeah.
You know, have a little longer season there, a little bit warmer early in the season down there. And we have had a lot of warm weather here in March. In fact, many of the days in March have been well above normal temperatures. You know, it's been a record warm March.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. We had some. The organization BearWise put out a list of how you can avoid interactions with bears that could be dangerous. We could go through that right now.
Okay.
Because bears are out now. There are a lot of bears are out. Maybe three times in the last week, I was driving on the parkway and there were people stopped in both directions because there was a bear near the side of the road.
Okay. You know, I haven't seen a bear this spring, but I finally had my first bear visit to my house, where one of my metal bird feeder poles was pulled down towards the ground,
right,
and all the birds who was taken out of the bird seat feeder that's there, and only a bear is strong enough to pull a bird feeding pole down made out of metal and bend it down towards the ground. So I know that I've been visited at least once by a bear in the nighttime hours, or maybe in the daytime hours when I just wasn't there, but I think I saw it the next morning after I went to bed. So bears are waking up and they're moving around.
They're moving around. So BearWise says.
And they're hungry.
That's
right. So they didn't eat a whole lot during the winter, did
they? That's right. No, they're hungry, looking for something to eat. Are
people on the diet list for bears?
No, people are not. But
that's not the kind of interaction we have to worry about.
Not the carnivore. What is that called? Predatory. Not the predatory type. Yeah. It said, according to BearWise, more than half of the human bear encounters, there's a dog involved.
Yeah.
And so the first tip they give is, keep your dog on a leash.
So they try to eat dogs?
No, it's just an interaction. But you know,
what do you mean an interaction?
There's been a lot of.
What is an interaction with a bear?
A dog running at the bear.
I mean, if you just see a bear
responding
in the woods, 100 feet away, walking, is that an interaction with a bear?
An interaction is where you are doing a movement and the bear is responding with a movement, and you are both acting. You're interacting.
You're getting very close to each other.
Yes.
And like it could be in a defensive aggressive situation where somebody may do something wrong or say the wrong thing, and it's not just casually seeing a bear in the woods as you go hiking.
No, that's an observation.
Okay, all right.
No, an interaction would be like the time I came around the bend on a trail and there was a female bear with three cubs, and I took a step backward and fell down, and the bear did a bluff charge at me.
That was definitely an interaction. In other words, an interaction where the bear and the person and or the dog or all three they notice each other, and they communicate one with another by sounds, observation, sound, movement, or whatever. There's an interaction.
That's right. So the action of one produces a reaction in the other. Anyway, so keep your dog on a leash is the number one thing.
Now, why would a bear? Are you saying that bears bother dogs, or do dogs bother bears?
Dogs bother bears.
Okay, and why do dogs bother bears?
Because the dogs run up, barking, charging at the bear.
And why do they do that?
Because they're dogs.
Well, some dogs may not do that, but some dogs do. You know, dogs are often protective of their owners.
Yeah, that's true.
But also, they're curious.
And also, dogs at one time were used to hunt bears.
Right, yeah. And what about, you know, sometimes people are walking their dog and they meet another dog, and you see dogs, how they, some dogs will greet each other friendly, but most dogs bark at another dog nearby them.
Right.
So if you see another animal like a bear, they're also going to bark and be like that, and then they see this animal's a whole lot bigger. Uh-huh. It doesn't even smell like a dog, and they probably are somewhat frightened. But even if they're frightened, they are sometimes stupid enough or not using common sense like people would, that they'll actually go chase and try to attack a bear or something like that. And then if something is attacking you, you have every right to try to defend yourself.
Right.
But usually if somebody's out walking a dog, normally the bear is not going to say, oh, there's a dog, I'm going to go over there and bite the dog or try to eat the dog or something like that. It's usually the dog causes a bear to have to defend itself because the bear is being maybe attacked
by the dog.
By the dog.
So that leads us to BearWise's next point. Trying to save your dog at that moment is extremely dangerous.
Right.
You don't try to get between the bear and your dog that is attacking the bear.
Right. You know,
that's a good tip.
There's somebody I work with an organization I work with, and we had a little meeting the other day, and she was late to the meeting because she had an interaction between two of her cats who were trying to fight.
Uh-huh.
And then she got in between them, and she got bitten and had to go to the hospital to get a tetanus shot or something like that. So, you just, you know, I mean, if a bear was trying to eat your child or something like that, which is not normally going to happen, you would probably reach and do anything you can. But you're usually not helping the dog by trying to come in between the dog and the bear. I mean, you can yell at your dog, just don't at least pull on your dog, whatever, throw rocks at the bear or whatever, but don't reach in there physically, because you may end up becoming a part of that interaction.
That's right. So that was tip number one, keep your dog on a leash. Tip number two, never approach a bear. So if you see a bear out in the woods, you know, you observe it and so forth, mm-hmm. but you don't, you know, get closer and closer to the bear to get a good photo or to get a better look at it. Never approach a bear. That's
Have you ever broken that rule, Dan?
No. Have you?
Oh, yes.
Maybe you have.
Oh, yes.
Okay, you want to get a picture?
But I've always done it in a most safe manner.
Okay. All right.
I'm not chasing the bear right behind it, trying to catch up, but I have walked parallel, uh-huh. 50 feet or more away from a bear, just moving away, uh-huh. trying to maybe get a picture of it as it comes through an opening or something like that, but not in a way that would be a bear would see that it was aggressive.
Okay.
Because bears usually will run away from you.
Usually will, yeah. Okay, tip number three, carry safety tools. What would be a safety tool?
Big old gun! maybe bear spray?
Yeah, bear spray.
Oh, and whistle, make a loud
whistle,
sound.
Whistle, that's what they say. Yeah, whistle and a bear spray, okay. So that's good. Number four, make noise on trails.
But if you make noise, you'll scare away all the wildlife.
Oh, yeah. To avoid surprising a bear. Yeah. So you can talk loud. Right. You can, some people, I don't know if anyone still does this, carry a bell.
Because, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people hike alone.
Yeah.
And let's face it, you see somebody walk along talking to themselves, you're going to say, something wrong with you. You know, first time I ever saw somebody wearing one of those little things in the ear that people talk on their phone with.
Right.
They were in a grocery store, and I thought they were mentally ill or something, because they were just, I thought they were talking to themselves.
Uh-huh.
And I started watching them. This was several years ago, and oh, there's something in his ear. Oh, maybe that's some kind of ear thing, piece, you know. But I was really shocked the first time I saw that. But now it's pretty routine.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty normal now. Yeah.
But I kind of like to walk quiet in hopes I can sneak up on deer and things like that. But you know, you could surprise a bear around the corner like you did with the where you
see. If I had been talking loudly, that wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, I have done that on a couple trails coming out of the Smokies, mm-hmm. in the evening. And I can see a bear like 100 yards or more down the trail, and it's the trail I have to walk on. I just start talking loudly to myself, and the bear usually, you know, it takes heed of that and gets out of the way. Yeah. So I've done the talking to myself. The other thing that works, if you take
When you talk to yourself, Dan, what do you say to yourself?
I just say something like, if I were you, I'd get out of the trail because there's a virile male approaching you. Something.
So you're really
except
talking
I would
to
say it with a very deep voice.
In other
voice.
Words, you're talking to the bear.
Yeah.
But you're talking to yourself about the bear as if the bear was able to hear you.
I was giving the bear some good advice.
Okay.
The other thing that has worked a few times is take a fallen stick. Usually it's got to be 3 or 4 inches in diameter. Mm-hmm. And just swing it like a baseball bat a couple times against a tree trunk and make a really loud noise. And the bears will hear that, and they'll usually vacate the area. And, okay, the last one, store food safely when camping. And so they have bear-proof containers you can get if you're camping. And they're plastic, probably 2 or 3 gallon plastic containers. They're round like a can.
A lot of times they call them a bear vault.
Or a bear vault.
Yeah.
With a tight-fitting lid. And in some places out in California, you're required to have one before you can go camping.
Yeah, some places in the mountains, I think it's required, too.
But, you know, some places in the East, bears have figured out how to open those.
Oh, yeah.
And so, it's, even though it's required, you know, out west in California, here it might not always work. So
I think that's probably one of the biggest problems with people around our areas camping in bear country, which is practically everywhere, and bears are hungry, and bears realize that people are pretty weak, and they often have food with them, and you know, there's a lot of bears that can't resist that lure of that food, you know.
Yeah.
And you can see why they would like to get that. So I think that is one way that many people have an interaction with a bear, like it or not, is related to food.
Yeah. My very first visit to the Smoky Mountains back around 1971. Undergraduate student came down with a school field trip. The first night we were camping, we had picnic tables and a campground. We left on the picnic table a marinating steak, which we were going to have the next day, and a chocolate cake. And for some reason, a bear came that night and ate that
You left
food.
It outside at, yeah. in the dark.
We didn't know. We didn't know anything at that time.
That sounded like, how could you be so, I mean, I wouldn't have necessarily thought about a bear. What about a raccoon or a possum or...
Yeah.
Y'all must not have had any experience with wild animals at all.
No.
Nighttime is when they start to roam around.
Yeah.
And they're looking for things to eat.
Obviously. But we had, you know.
You were a real greenhorn, weren't you?
Yeah, we were from Cleveland, Ohio. None of us had been.
A greenhorn Yankee at that.
From, had been out anywhere in the woods. And so we signed up for this class and came down and. Well, we quickly learned our lesson after that.
Yeah.
So, so keep your food in a safe place.
Yeah.
Okay, that's all they have from BearWise.
Yeah, so BearWise is an organization. They have a website. It's called BearWise.org. Once again, it's BearWise.org. And it's actually a cooperation between several agencies, including the North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission and others. And because of all the bear issues and interactions and that we all live in bear country in the mountains, that's become a very big deal over the past 20, 30 years in the mountains. And people have a lot of problems with bear interactions, good or bad. We need to learn to live with bears, and how can we feed animals and have our picnics and go camping with all the bears trying to get your food and stuff. The bears have changed their behavior in the past few decades. They used to be very shy and never go near people. They're not like that anymore, even though it's still a person is usually a scary thing to a bear. But bears are hungry. We have more bears around. We have more people in bear country. We have more people building houses where bears used to live in the woods and wouldn't have competition with people. So the BearWise.org on the online website there provides all kinds of information and good resources for learning how to live around bears in what we call bear country. In other words, anywhere here in West North Carolina, even within the city limits, could be considered bear country. You'd be surprised at how many bears show up in different areas where years ago they would never have been seen.
Oh yeah, yeah. Remember when you had to either go to the Black Mountains or to the Smokies to see a bear?
Right.
And that wasn't that long. That may be in the 1980s. That's getting pretty long ago. But
yeah, but things are different now.
Yeah. All right, we should give our contact information.
Yeah, I'm gonna say it's time for us to take a little pause here. Not for a commercial break, but we're gonna pause and tell you how to get in touch with us here at Nature News. Give you our contact information.
Yeah.
And then we'll come back with the second half of our program with more Nature News, so stay tuned.
Okay, if you want to contact us, probably the easiest way is to send us an email, and you can also send us a photograph by doing that. Our email address is naturenewswnc@gmail.com. Or you can telephone us. Our phone number is 828-891-5169, and we won't answer the phone. We'll take a message. Our machine will take a message. That's 828-891-5169, or you can send us a card or letter at Nature News 3150 North Mills River Road, Mills River, North Carolina, 28759. That's Nature News 3150 North Mills River Road, Mills River, North Carolina, 28759.
Nice. Remember our email address, naturenewswnc@gmail.com. Telephone number, 828 area code, 891-5169, 24 hours a day, or letters and postcards addressed under Nature News 3150 North Mills River Road, Mills River, North Carolina, zip code 28759. And remember, if you want to listen to Nature News on demand without getting up early on a Saturday morning from 7 to 8 a.m. and tuning into your radio, we are broadcast on WTZQ 1600 a.m. and 95.3 FM out of Hendersonville, North Carolina. But by going to their website at WTZQ.com and clicking on the program tab, you'll see a lot of programs pop up on their website there, including Nature News. If you click on the words Nature News when you do that, it will redirect you to our web presence on their webpage. And you'll see that you can listen to the most recent 4 to 5 broadcasts of Nature News with a little description there. And you can stream it whatever listening device you have any time of the day or night you wish. And by digging a little bit deeper, I think scrolling towards the bottom of the page, you'll find a link where you can also listen to some other back broadcasts of Nature News from like a year or so ago as well. So many people listen to Nature News that way on demand or often, but just because it's hard to get a radio signal in many parts of the mountains here. And of course, if you can access the internet at WTZQ.com, theoretically you can listen to Nature News anywhere on the face of the earth.
Right. Okay, let's move along to our wildflower list.
All right, Dan's got an extensive wildflower list.
And we're going to have wildflower lists from now until October.
That's right.
We're getting into the season.
Right.
And just driving over to the studio, I noticed in some of the fields a plant that some of the farmers around here call Yellow Rocket.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a 16-inch tall member of the mustard family with yellow families. Botanists call it Barbaria vulgaris. Some people call it wintercress. Anyway, that's up. And if you get to more of a kind of roadside wet ditch area, you'll see a similar plant, which is also about 16 inches tall, very intense yellow flower at the top, called Golden Ragwort. That's also in bloom. But I wanted to go into this list, if I could find it here, on this trail to Melrose Falls near Saluda, North Carolina, on the way down into South Carolina. And
that's along what we were mentioning earlier, called the Blue Ridge Escarpments. So it's still here in West North Carolina, but it's down at a little bit of a lower elevation.
Yeah.
And that's also a very rich wildfire. There's a lot of land down there that's not developed. A lot of it is in conservation easements and stuff like that are protected by some conservancies. And it's just naturally a very rich area of very rich soil, wildflowers, trees and things. And where you have rich soils like that in a place like that, along the edge of the mountains here, you're going to have a lot of wildflowers. And
that's
just noted for many, many wildflowers in that area.
Right. So we ended a little hike there to the falls, which is less than a mile.
Who's we?
Several friends and I.
Dan, am I your friend?
Yeah, several of my other... You're not my only friend.
Okay, but I wasn't invited, was I?
Your name must have fallen off the invite.
You have a lot of nerve, Dan, going on a wildflower hike here in early spring down to a place like Melrose Falls on that protected land down there, and then coming back here to your friend of how long have we known each other?
Yeah, I don't know, 40-something years.
Yes, and coming back here, and how long have we been doing Nature News together and reporting on things from the world of Nature?
30-something years.
And coming here, walking into the studio here, sitting down, and tell me about how he went on this walk with all his friends early in the week. Well, not all of them, but evidently there was at least one friend that was not even invited. And his name is me, Carlton Burke, his co-host at Nature News. Now, I'm not complaining. I'm sure if you had called me and asked me, I would probably have told you, Dan, I'm not available. I'm working that day.
Yeah, well, I knew you were working.
But you never even asked.
Well, why would I ask if I knew you were working?
But how would you know I'm working? Are you stalking me and know what my schedule is?
And plus, I didn't waltz into the studio. I walked in. Anyway, let's get to the wildflower list.
I'm just saying, Dan.
Okay.
First
of all, you know, there are a lot of roadside wildflowers you can see along almost any roadside lawn at this time of year. A lot of them are real small. So you get out of the car, you'll see this little blue... flower looks a little bit kind of violet shaped, called Bird's Eye Speedwell, which we talked about last week. And then there's a plant that is about a foot tall, has tiny, tiny little yellow flowers on top, and that is a really small buttercup. It's called Small Flowered Buttercup. So you see these right on the edge of the road, and a lot of blue violets are right there before you get in the woods. There's a little bluet, which has four tiny petals that are kind of blue, orange, and white. That's the tiny bluet.
I saw some bluets this week.
Did you? Probably the tiny bluet.
I was out working with some students one day on their nature trail at their school over in Henderson County, and there was this beautiful little clump of bluets. You know, when it first comes, it always looks like little grassy flowers or something like that, but they come up, and they only get a few inches high, and then like there's a little beautiful little flower heads, but almost always in a little clump, and they sometimes are called Quaker ladies.
Yeah.
And they're early spring wildflower, and I love those little guys.
I do too. They're
because they're so
pretty.
Small and delicate, very, very pretty. And where I saw was they're going to a rather dry site. Usually they seem like some pretty damp locations. You know, we've been pretty dry lately, so maybe where I saw them growing is normally is damper, but I saw those on my own little hike earlier in the week.
Oh, good.
When I was out educating fifth graders about science in the outdoors, while Dan was with his friends somewhere down the mountain, seeing all the other wildflowers in bloom.
There were a lot.
But I'm glad, Dan, that you have come here to share these things that I did not get a chance to see with me, so I'll know that they're out there.
That's right. So now you can go look for them in your spare time.
Yeah, on my own.
Not getting invited on a hike, it doesn't look like.
There's another plant out there that looks like a really small white violet, which is called the field pansy. Of course, along roadside, you see dandelion. There's another buttercup you call bristly buttercup, white clover. There's another little speedwell called time leaves speedwell. And so these are all little roadside ones. But when you get into the woods, let me get down here into the woods. Of course, flowering dogwood, mm-hmm. which is just coming to bloom here in the mountains.
Everybody will see them. Of course, you know, Dan's talking a lot about wildflowers that are herbaceous, but that is, I think, the first thing you mentioned, which is a woody tree.
Yeah.
Okay, so remember, wildflowers include anything that's in bloom.
Right.
So a dogwood is a tree, small tree.
Yeah. And there were three species of trillium down there. One of them was the purple toad shade, mm-hmm. Which has the upright petals and the mottled leaves. One of them was the large flowered white trillium, which is a lot of people's favorite plant, which grows in super abundance in some of the mountain coves. It's got three large white petals, three green sepals, six stamens, and a three-parted ovary, which is light colored. And so that was in bloom. But then there was this other one, which is usually called the sweet white trillium, which looks a little bit like the white trillium, but it's not exactly like it. For one thing, it has a purple ovary, so you can instantly tell it apart. But, you know, the trilliums in our whole region.
Yeah, Dan?
Yes?
You know, the average person mm-hmm. might be surprised to say a trillium has ovaries.
Yeah.
When we think of ovaries, don't we normally think of mammals, you know, that give birth and uh-huh. and that's part of the reproductive system?
Right.
But trilliums have ovaries?
Yeah. So the ovaries would be the, you know, like a human ovary, what's enclosed within a human ovary.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Oh, well, eventually it produces a seed.
Well, I'm talking the human ovaries.
Oh, human ovaries.
Yeah.
I'm not going to talk about that.
Okay, well, ovary produces a baby, the seeds are produced inside of the plant ovary, which is analogous to the human ovary. Anyway, so you can tell it apart, but you know.
But I just thought that was the news. Some people don't know that about the flower parts. They would have some names that might sound familiar.
Okay. Well, good. I'm glad we explained that.
Yeah.
you know, we have probably 10 or 12 types of trilliums in our area that are referred to as species. And technically a species is a population of organisms that interbreeds but does not produce fertile offspring when bred to another species. But our trilliums in our area have a lot of variation. And in fact, we've got a number of trilliums that cross hybridize with each other. And they're all in one group, which includes the sweet white trillium. And it crosses with a lot of them, and you got a lot of different forms in different areas. And so almost any cove you go into in the southern Appalachians, you have a chance to see a variety of trillium, which might be restricted just to that cove or to a few other areas. But the sweet white trillium is actually related to the red trillium. What's that one called? That comes up early with the three red petals. Trillium erectum, it has a common name. Wake robin.
Yeah.
So they're both in the same group and they can cross with each other. And also Vases trillium is in that mm-hmm. same group. So there's really eight species in that trillium erectum complex. And we see all kinds of crosses. So anyway, nature doesn't believe in species. Nature just does what it does. And these populations of trilliums probably were separated from each other during the recent ice age. And probably had different refugia in different parts of the coastal plain, maybe off the coastal plain when the sea level was lower, possibly in some of the coves opening at the southern part of the Blue Ridge, which is kind of where we were on this hike. And since the ice has retreated, all these populations have come back and merged with each other. They were in the process of differentiating, and now they're crossing back with each other. So we have a very rich group of trilliums and a very large number of trilliums. There are 10 or 12 named species, but there are also varieties, and probably you can find your own variety if you look hard enough for trilliums. So this was a very rich area for looking at these beautiful, beautiful flowers of spring, the trilliums. So that's only a few. We're not gonna go through all 68. Silver bell trees were in flower. It's a large canopy tree with little white bell-shaped flowers dangling down. Should be called ivory bell, not silver bell. Oh, also, Carlton, the cucumber trees with the yellow flowers were in bloom, and this is an unusual subspecies of cucumber tree, where the flowers are bright lemon yellow, and they're only found in a few areas. The sassafras tree was in bloom. A little spring beauties were in bloom. The we saw one sugar maple tree, but it was in flower. Several types of violets. The wild ginger, which has the thick purplish flower lying right on the ground, and a very fragrant root which has been used in the past as a flavoring for some of the pioneer cooking. That's a very interesting plant, very sweet-smelling rhizome. That was in bloom down there. Oh, man, so many. I guess no need to go through this entire list. Fraser magnolia was in bloom. Spice bush was in bloom. May apple was in bloom. Let's just say that it was a wildflower paradise, partly because this area is in kind of a thermal belt. It's in an area where cold air drains all the way down the ridge to the Piedmont and forms a layer of cold air lying below the elevation of this trail. And partly because the trail is partway below the surface of the mountains, so the cold air kind of drains down. It leaves a little warm band. When you go up too far above it, it gets cold again. So it's what they call a thermal belt, an area on the side of the mountain where the cold air drains away and is not high enough to be in the colder air up above. And for that reason, we've got a lot of wildflowers that grow there. So anyway, we don't need to go through 68 species in less than a mile just to say that it's a very rich area.
Yeah, when you go on a wildflower hike like that, you can't walk very far if you stop and make a list of all the wildflowers you see, because sometimes you stand there and there's maybe 10 things in one spot.
Yeah.
You know, of course, these are mostly ephemeral wildflowers that bloom early in spring down on the forest floor. And that's their heyday. They're trying to get in their photosynthesis and build up starch in their roots and food sources and get strong and hefty and pumped up for the season before they get shaded out by the trees overhead when the leaves start coming out. So usually by the end of April, by May 1st, places down there are usually fully in leaf. And some of the lower elevations here are getting that direction too. But the higher elevations will take a few more weeks really before they get the leaves out. But this is a special time of year when we have those early spring ephemeral wildflowers come out. So if you get a chance and you have a friend, maybe invite them on a hike. Yeah. Otherwise, if you're like me, maybe just find some time to go on your own and enjoy the solitude.
Yeah. It's nice to be on your own in the woods, too. So I wanted to give you that.
I noticed you didn't go by yourself. How many friends did you take with you, Dan?
Five or six.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fun.
I see.
Well, you were working.
You couldn't know that.
I know your schedule.
Okay.
All right.
Well, we only have a little bit left here at Nature News, but we can easily fill that up. And part of the remaining time here, before we leave the air, I think we should have a What's in My Pocket installment.
All right.
And talk about that. Then we're going to come back and give you our contact information one more time. And then if anything, don't we have a listener question we need to get to today?
Yeah, we do.
As well?
Do you want to hold that for the end or do it now?
We'll just do that right after What's in My Pocket.
Okay, all right.
All right. So What's in My Pocket is just something we throw in every once in a while. So something interesting for World of Nature that one of us has put in our pocket, and we get the other person to guess about it, and we take it out and we talk about it. So in my pocket.
Should I close my eyes?
What I'm going to do, Dan, I'm going to reach in and pull it out in what's in my pocket. And I want you to close your eyes.
Okay.
And I'm going to put it up near the microphone. I'm going to manipulate it so that people hear it. And then I'm going to put a big wad of it in your hand. And then you're going to feel it, and you're going to try to ask me some questions, guess what it is, or if you need to know what it's animal, mineral, vegetable, or whatever, you're going to ask questions like that, and then we'll see if you figure out what it is. But when you open your eyes, I know you'll know what it is.
Okay, at the microphone, it sounded like a cellophane bag that you brought
lunch
in.
Yeah.
But feeling it, it's obviously either a shredded cellophane bag, but it's not perfectly smooth. It has like little, feels a little bit like the... what's that packing material that has little bubbles?
There's bubble wrap.
Yeah, a little bit
But remember, this is a natural material. Wrap. This ain't no man-made material.
Right. And
this is something from the world of nature.
Oh, as I spread it out, it's starting to take shape here. It's very long and narrow, so obviously this is some kind of shed snake skin. that you brought back.
You're right, it is a Shed Snakeskin. And that's just only a portion of it.
Yeah.
That's a portion of it.
Really?
That portion is kind of tore apart.
Can I open my eyes now?
Yes, you may.
Whoa, that's pretty big.
Yeah, and that's, like I said, that's just only a foot long section.
Yeah, yeah.
And you
can tell
that the snake that shed that was pretty big. And
so I was feeling the kind of involuted scales on the
Snakes, shed snakeskin has always fascinated me because, you know, even people that don't like snakes, they'll find a shed snakeskin and they want to know what kind of snake shed it. You know, and believe it or not, you can tell because a shed snakeskin is an inside-out replica of the snake that shed it. So when a snake skin has to heal from cuts, injuries, or just grow a bit bigger if you're growing, a particular young snake will shed more often than an adult. So once they go into a process where they shed their old skin, they got to grow their new skin, so they lose their color. Colorful snakes become very dull in color. Many snakes can't see out of their eye spectacle, which is a clear covering, covers their eye, because this fluid that's forming a new skin is underneath the old skin there. But after a few days of that snake hiding in isolation somewhere, you know, not going out because it can't see very well, it suddenly clears up. The new skin starts to harden underneath the old skin, and they go out and they rub their nose on a rock or a branch or something like that, and they start to peel the skin off their lips and over the tips of their nose and out over the eye, and it just peels off as they literally crawl inside out of the old skin all the way to the tail tip, leaving behind a perfect replica inside to out from the one end of the snake to the other.
It's like a fingerprint.
Yeah, it is. And you see all the scales that are there, all the little indentations of scales, all the scale details that are on the head. You see the eye cap will come off on the head of the snake.
Even the color pattern.
Right, and if there's any kind of color in there, you know, this is kind of like black and white TV. You won't see color, but wherever there's color, like a red blotch or something would show up as a very dark blackish mark on the skin, and something that was very grayish will look kind of like very light grayish in color. In other words, you see the remnants of the pattern on there.
Yeah.
And you see the little ridges on scales that certain types of snakes have. And if you know a little bit about your shed snake's skins, you can sometimes take that to a book and identify it. But if you know a little bit about them and you find a recently shed snakeskin, you can identify it.
Right.
And
well, this one, being the size that it is, and these kind of pattern, is to me, got to be a rattlesnake.
Yeah, this is a rattlesnake, section of a rattlesnake skin.
Yeah. And can you tell from this shed skin, is there any way to tell the sex, the gender?
If you have the entire skin, so wherever it goes and shed, when you get down to where the tail is, you know, snakes actually have a tail, they have a little opening called the vent or cloaca. And from that point on, a snake's tail, whether it's a male or female, will be of a certain length and thickness. And if you have the tail end of the snake's shed skin and it doesn't get torn or broken when it's pulled off there, you can usually tell whether it's a male or female with some accuracy. But you always have to remember that shed snake skin stretch. And like if you found a 4 foot long snake skin, that was 4 feet long, the snake that shed was probably 3 feet long or 3.5. So a dead skin stretches quite a bit. So when you see a big skin, it's not quite as big as a snake that shed it. So sometimes when they twist and pull that shed, you know, particularly around the tail area, it might distort it a little bit enough, and you can't quite tell the thickness or the length of the tail accurately on certain type of snake species. But it's definitely a very interesting, and we see sometimes shed snake skins, and you'll never see the snake to shed it. Sometimes you'll be in a location like an old barn or something like that, and you'll find dozens of old shed snakes, and you won't ever see any single snake at all. So, you know, most adult snakes shed their skin maybe 3 or 4 times a year. Young snakes shed their skin as they're growing, sometimes as often as once a month or so. And shed snake skins, unless they're inside and where they're protected there, it's very easy for them to get torn up and, you know, blown away by the wind, and they decompose very quickly. But also, you know, a lot of snakes, when they first come out in the springtime, will shed their skin for very soon because they've been under hibernation or brumation all winter long, you know. And it's just one of those things like you work in a garden, you want to come in and you want to take a shower and wash all the dirt off. They do that, you know, first thing in the spring a lot of times.
Do they need to, like, rub up against something when they're starting to shed?
Yeah, to rub against a bark of a tree or a little rock or something rough.
Yeah.
And you get it peeled out over their head and neck. And then at that point, they can literally slowly crawl out of the old skin. You know, there's no myth that says that old timers used to say that snakes were blind in the spring.
Yeah.
And that's because many snakes come out of hibernation getting ready to shed like that, and then they may see that bluish cast that the eyes have when they're totally clear.
They look like they're blind.
Yeah, and so a lot of snakes do shed their skin early in the year, and they just can't see very well during that period until they actually shed the skin. But it is interesting, and you know, shed skins are sometimes picked up by birds like flycatchers. They've been known to put them in their nest. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the great crested flycatcher, if I'm not mistaken, feels like his nest is not complete until it gets a shed snake skin and tucks it in there. And I don't know, that's kind of like the crown and glory said, I need this nest to make it look prettier. Maybe a shed snake skin makes him feel like, oh, anything else come by? Oh, I don't know, there's a snake been there recently. I don't want to have anything to do with that nest. So whatever, you know, but it's interesting things. And
no, this is really good. Yeah. What's in my pocket?
Yeah, yeah. So shed snake skin or fasting?
Yeah. Is there any way to tell the age of a snake by looking at a shed skin?
No. Just the size of the snake and how fast it grows. And
yeah,
you know, certain snakes only reach certain lengths. So
yeah,
there's little things you need to know about a snake.
Right.
That you can't always discern from a shed snake skin, but literally they're the perfect inside-out copy of the snake.
Right.
Very useful for identification and clarification that this type of snake actually exists somewhere where you may not actually ever see it.
Right, right. Okay, well, that was good. That was really good. What's in my pocket? I think we're running out of time
here. So we better give our contact information, and then we'll
sign answer this question next week.
Okay, unless it's a real quick question.
No, we'll have to talk a little more. We'll wait until next week.
Should we give a little hint?
Hmm.
Would people want maybe tune in that week just to hear the answer to this question?
We want to leave
a complete mystery.
It involves kudzu.
Kudzu.
Yeah.
Everybody's held a kudzu.
Yeah. So the question involves that. Okay, so if you want to contact us or ask us another question, you can email us. And our email address is naturenewswnc. WNC stands for Western North Carolina. naturenewswnc@gmail.com. Our telephone number is 828-891-5169. Our mailing address is Nature News, 3150 North Mills River Road, Mills River, North Carolina, 28759. And if you'd like to listen to Nature News on the internet, where you might get better reception, or you might be out of the range of our station, which is WTZQ, you can go to the WTZQ webpage, click down to programs, scroll down to programs, and click on programs, and you'll see Nature News. Click on that, and you can either listen live while we're being broadcast, or you can listen anytime after broadcast for the next month. It's going to be up there.
Right.
So
that's at WTZQ.com.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for listening to our program. Get out there and enjoy these beautiful spring days. Go out and look at wildflowers. Observe the birds as they're coming through. Until next week, this is Dan Lazar.
And I'm Carlton Burke.
Stay tuned, listening to this same station. We'll be back again next Saturday morning at the same time with another edition of
Nature News.